this is Lynna Live with my regular program. I'm Lynna Mirmont, and even though program is regular, but the guest is incredibly outstanding individual. His book, Walkable City, Took Country by the Storm, and the idea and the concept is how to save America by reviving downtown. In fact, to be very precise, after title and a very attractive looking, dynamically arranged walkable city book, it says how downtown can save America one step at a time. I cautiously will integrate my own words, and I would say one stop at a time. Jeff Speck, you're welcome. Thank you so much for finding time in your extremely taken already schedule. And I like for change to give you, as my very special guest, to make your own introduction and tell a little bit about yourself and those fantastic human roots which brought you to write such incredibly useful and wise book.
Well, thank you. It's hard to follow an introduction like that. But the title of the book is Walkable City, How Downtown Can Save America One Step at a Time. And I'm a city planner. I was trained as an architect, but found out fairly quickly that the design scale that was most interesting to me was the scale of the neighborhood, or the scale even a bit bigger of the city, because architecture was, for me, losing its meaning and its purpose as a result of where, in most cases, it was being cited. I'm someone who, in the 80s, stumbled upon the work of a husband and wife named Andres Dwani and Elizabeth Plater-Zyberg. And they had founded this movement called the New Urbanism Movement, which is essentially a battle cry against suburban sprawl. And it was a recognition that as hard as they worked as architects to make, you know, good buildings and ethical buildings and proper buildings, most of the sites for buildings in the latter half of the 20th century were not found in cities where they could contribute to a, walkable, productive, pleasant pedestrian environment, but were in sprawl, where they were most often located across large parking lots at the end of cul-de-sacs. And recognizing that even the best building was perhaps not the sort of environment that we were trained in school to enjoy, when the places between the buildings were so barren and the lifestyle that we were consigned to in these environments was one of having the automobile not as an instrument of freedom but as a prosthetic device, you know, necessary to accomplish your daily needs, led to this movement that eventually became known as the New Urbanism, which was essentially a return to traditional neighborhood design practices. Not traditional in the sense of traditional-looking architecture, although, you know, traditional styles of architecture are welcome in new urbanist work, but more turning away from the auto-centric patterns of sprawl development, highways connecting to arterials, connecting to collector roads, connecting to parking lots and cul-de-sacs, and turning back to the way that we used to make cities, which was buildings forming blocks surrounded by streets, interspersed with parks, all connected ideally in a transit system to a larger city, and that we used to make places like that only as a matter of course, but it was the only way that humans built cities from the time they had stopped being nomads until the time that we became enamored of the automobile to such a degree that we entirely remade the profession of planning around the idea that we would use cars to get everywhere. And whereas the you know, the fact that we used to be pedestrians only resulted in very walkable, livable neighborhoods. And then the advent of rail transportation actually reinforced those neighborhoods because it was nodal. It only stopped in certain places, and therefore places of interest would grow around those few places where the rail car stopped. But then with the advent of the automobile, essentially it equalized the whole landscape. Anywhere where you could throw down 20 feet width of tarmac became equal to anywhere else. And that was really the dissolution of the nodal, you know, urban way of making places that had made the places that we all loved so much. So this whole movement that I arose out of has been about both finding ways to replace the autocentric planning principles, which have dominated for the past 50 years, with a return to more traditional city-making principles, but also a focus on, rather than making more places, new sprawling communities, why don't we look at the places we've already got that are so well-organized, that grew up around pedestrians or around trains, that we've perhaps neglected over the past decades, and let's make them better, perhaps make them more urban and more like they originally were in terms of them being mixed use and dense and active. And maybe let's try and convince people to live in these places once again. And that, as you know, is a big part of the argument of the book is, on the one hand, we need to make our existing cities better for them to be competitive. On the other hand, a lot of us as individuals have the choice about where we want to live. And perhaps we can make that choice with our feet and move back to some of the traditional neighborhoods that we may not live so far away from right now.
Exactly points you made, and I like to make my own a little bit, which were actually inspired by your book, because you make one to think what we're missing. And this is very invisible but very powerful line in between what is human and what is material, because in your 4 points, I believe it's useful, safe, comfort, and interesting walk, I would combine with other dimensions, and sounds a bit heavy, but I believe that intergenerational connections can derive as indeed as a result of your proposed concept and actual planning, because you mentioned this in your book, exactly don't remember where, but it is such a painful subject of elderly driving when they're supposed to walk and enjoy safety and comfort. And I believe that European model, where everything is physically closer, you can see in much a regular basis when young and old are together, they're sharing a conversation and outside cafes. I call it meeting of the elbows, sometimes beautifully combined with a meeting of the minds. So I found this book particularly fascinating because he was a city planner. And we depend on the city halls, we depend on our government, we depend on people who are indeed supposed to be logical, productive, and helpful in the city plans. And I think you are tactfully so, but criticizing those people because they're the one who's somehow disconnected from real people, from real life, and from real coming back to what America should symbolize, which is indeed humanity. So can you comment how you can be optimistic in integrating human ideas with a city planning concept to get us where we're supposed to be as a humans?
Well, I mean, Winston Churchill said, we make our cities and then our cities make us. Very much aware of the way that our environment enables us to not only interact or fail to interact in certain ways, but also might inspire us to think creatively or be creative people. The joke I like to say is, you know, it's one thing to bump into a person while walking and quite another to bump into them while driving. And if your experience of being in the public realm, which is the physical manifestation of what we share, is one in which you are endangered and endangering other people, which is the fundamental condition of driving, then your role as a citizen is vastly altered, you know, from someone with responsibilities to someone who is trying to survive. And so I always joke to say, you know, there's a big difference between a citizen and a motorist. When you're a motorist, you find yourself constantly annoyed, constantly trying to move more quickly through the environment that you're in, disconnected from the people around you. You know, even a few of us have convertibles, but even that isn't the same as being outside of a vehicle walking down the street. And frankly, at risk from the actions of all the people who are surrounding you, who in many cases are not driving safely and are indeed a true threat to you. And there's been a lot of discussion about road rage and, you know, asking the question, why do people lose their tempers so quickly when they're driving? And why do we behave so crazily sometimes in ways that surprise even ourselves when we're driving our automobiles? And they essentially point to the fact that deep down we know that our lives are in danger. So we kick into more of a caveman response because there is a very real threat that doesn't, you know, that doesn't face us when we're walking down the street. I always joke and say, you know, I've never flipped anyone the bird while I was walking. Well, I certainly have many times while I was driving. But you brought up a whole bunch of different issues, and I think one that you touched upon lightly that I would emphasize is the experience of the elderly in our society. And, you know, we new urbanists like to ask, where were the retirement homes before 1950? And the answer is there weren't any, or there were hardly any, because people could just retire in place. We lived in places in which once you lost your capacity to drive, you could still function very well walking slowly from place to place. Because we lived in mixed-use communities, by mixed-use we mean, we planners mean, you know, places to live, places to sleep, places to work, places to worship. And, of course, many Americans and most Europeans and certainly people in primitive cultures or developing nations still principally live in these environments where all these things are close at hand. But by creating a national landscape in which the automobile became this necessary tool for fulfilling our daily needs, and then selling ourselves on this myth that we would retire to some community, some gated community with golf and, you know, lush landscape, and that this would be our terminal location, we were tricking ourselves because, of course, what happens is when you hit a certain age, you're happy in the retirement community, and then when you hit a certain higher age, you really should not be driving. And many of us have relatives who should not be on the road and are. I've had many a perilous experience. I remember with my grandparents down in Florida, which is a place that collects these people who shouldn't be driving.
and
you know, they're a danger to those around them and to themselves. And you can't blame them, though, because they realize that the minute they give up those car keys, they are giving up their rights as citizens, and freedom becomes redefined as a, you know, as a bus that takes them from their new nursing home, which they have to move to the mall once a week so that they can get some shopping in. But it's not a choice that many people who really have the choice would make. And, you know, there's this phenomenon that sociologists identified as way back as the 80s called the NORC, the N-O-R-C, NORC, which is a naturally occurring retirement community. And the first one they identified was the Upper East Side of Manhattan, where basically older people who had enough wealth to make the choice would collect in this neighborhood where they could do everything they needed to do and not drive. And my parents, who are getting to the point where they're driving less and want to drive less, recently moved. Probably, you know, I had some influence on their choice. But, you know, I grew up on a half an acre lot in a leafy suburban town outside of Boston. And they recently moved from that half acre lot to a condominium in downtown Lexington, Massachusetts, which is it's a suburb, but the downtown has probably 3 hairdressers and 8 restaurants and 3 coffee shops and everything else you might want on a daily basis. And they're going to be productive there for much longer than they should be driving, because they have the luxury of making that choice.
You mentioned Massachusetts. I happen to know Lexington very well, among some other suburbs, and that is one of the model of very comfortable living, not only for actually retired people like your parents, but actually for young people. Yep. And I wanted to stretch even beyond that thought, but going to our healthcare, we are truly faced with a giant expense, no secret of obesity, no secret of some other chronic diseases, which can be greatly diminished if, number one, we will move more, and number two, we will have more of an interaction, which will create some human exchange and ultimately involve less drugs for some kind of mental needs. So when I was reading your book and I hit certain points, for example, shape the spaces, I always was thinking that actually space should work for you. This is totally irrelevant how big or small space is. It's almost like a human acoustic. When you in a concert hall, you either feel overwhelmed, lost, like in the big suburbs of loneliness and isolation, or you feel, which is a much more comfortable space, belongs to you or you're part of it. So your concept and some of your descriptions on the book are so vividly clear. I almost felt on those moments of downtown when I feel I'm not alone, when I can communicate, yeah. When window shopping is such a powerful thing, and you becoming less addicted to certain negative aspects of our life. And I don't really want to pose the question necessarily, but to comment on one thing which I was celebrating when I was reading, it's welcome bikes.
Right.
And we do have some stations in New York, but it is still needs to be, I believe, much more developed, should be more of a bicycle path, which would be like a twin parallel structure for the pedestrians, like walk sites. Talk a little bit about this bike vision of yours.
Well, you brought up a lot of points I want to briefly hit upon, but it's funny how New York City has managed to vastly increase, more than double its number of bicycle riders in very few recent years. But what's also interesting is still there aren't very many, because there were almost none before, for very good reason. But they've made great gains that we can learn from. But before returning to bikes, you know, you mentioned a number of things of interest. One, regarding the shape of urban spaces and the size of urban spaces. The city planner Jan Gehl, who's Scandinavian and has been helping New York City pedestrianize some pieces of Broadway, reminds us in his book, which is called Cities for People, how when you have a dinner party, it's always much livelier if you have narrow tables, because you can speak not just to the people on either side of you, but to the people across the table as well. So you have multiple choices of conversation partners. And we all know what it's like to be at a dinner party on a fat table. If the person to your left is boring, you're stuck really with only one person you can talk to.
Yes.
But he says that's a that's a good analogy for urban spaces and what I call the tiniest taster, tastier principle, that generally speaking in America, we do make our urban spaces too big and they're not properly shaped with what we planners call street walls, you know, those edges that give them their shape, that make them feel like outdoor living rooms, and that it's really essential to our decision to use public space that spaces be shaped properly in this way. And that's really the comfortable aspect of the useful, safe, comfortable, and interesting walk that I like to talk about. You also talked about, and this ties into bicycling, but you also talked about our obesity epidemic. And in fact, I make no bones about stating, and I say it with confidence, that the health crisis in America is an urban design crisis. And for many years, all we looked at was diet. And, of course, our diet in America is horrible. And you can turn to Michael Pollan and other people about the way that we grow the wrong foods and we subsidize the wrong foods. And you know, our corn syrup-based diet is at the heart of a lot of the problems that we have. But that the more recent studies have been comparing the impacts of diet on our national waistline to the impacts of inactivity, and the fact that we have designed out of existence for many of our communities and many of our children the useful walk. You know, there's no longer such a thing as the walk to the store or the walk to the soccer field. You know, or the I grew up in a traditional community. I could walk to my dad's office. I walked to school. Most people my age, approaching 50, had that experience. In the 70s, more than half of children walk to school. Now fewer than 15% of children walk to school. And there have been a number of very interesting studies that have finally compared the impact of activity to the impact of diet. One of them was a British study called Gluttony versus Sloth, which documented pretty clearly that inactivity had a much bigger impact on patients who were studied than their diet. Another fellow, Dr. James Levine at the Mayo Clinic, put people, this was covered in the New York Times Sunday magazine, he put people in motion detecting underwear, a big study, put them on a steady regime, held all their weight steady, and then started pumping calories into their diet, and found that those patients who gained, I should say, you know, study participants who gained weight, certain study participants gained a lot of weight and certain study participants didn't gain a lot of weight. And they suspected that there was some sort of, genetic factor at work. What they found, though, was that the only way they could distinguish between those who gained weight and those who didn't was the amount of activity that they underwent, and that the people who didn't gain weight were making, you know, dozens more motions a minute than those who did. And, in fact, those who gained weight tended to sit per day 2 hours more than those who didn't. And just study after study now, even where they've looked at the weight of people in, quote-unquote, high walkable and low walkable neighborhoods of different cities, finding there's a dramatic correlation. You know, zeroing out for age and income and all those other things, making sure that those are not factors in the discussion, in the experiment, finding that people who live in high walkable neighborhoods are much less likely to be overweight or obese than people in low walkable neighborhoods. So there's all this data now. Still, the national conversation about our health is one principally about diet and not about inactivity. And I guess you can see why, because it's kind of hard to overnight overnight you can change your diet, but overnight you can't change your city. But we are changing our cities. We have changed them in the wrong way, which has resulted in this problem. And we can, with equal speed, change them back to a way that will solve this problem. One way we can do that is with bike lanes. And the amazing experience we've seen in New York City, but more prominently before that in Portland, Oregon, in Davis, California, in Boulder, Colorado, there are now hundreds of communities across the U.S., certainly any community that I'm working in, where bicycle lanes are being introduced. And as you suggest, not just the in-street bike lanes, which puts a skinny five-footer right next to three or four lanes of fast-moving traffic, but this concept of the separated lane. New York City has a few, Portland has a bunch, and we've got some here in D.C. We're adding them every month, it seems. We're adding another one. And it's pretty easy to do. You take a three-lane street or a four-lane street, and you take one lane out of it, and you replace that one lane with a buffer, which could be, you know, a constructed buffer like some curbs, but it could also just be some stripes that move you 3 feet away from the traffic. And then in the remaining 8 feet, because a typical lane is 11 feet, in the remaining 8 feet, you put a two-way bicycle lane, which is now separated from the roadway. The best version of this takes the parallel parking. Ideally, you start with parallel parking on the curb. It takes the parallel parking and pulls it 11 feet off the curb. So the bike lane is actually located between the curb and the parallel parking, separated by a buffer. New York City has some of these as well. I saw one the other day, I think, on 9th Avenue. So what we're finding is with the introduction of any sort of bicycle infrastructure, but certainly with the introduction of, particularly with the introduction of separated lanes and protected lanes, that the population of bikers jumps considerably. And as I always say, you know, as a planner, you're extremely wary of saying, you know, build it and they will come. There are very few things in planning which are build it and they will come. But one of them clearly is bike lanes, and that cities that add bicycle capacity, mint bicyclists. And, Portland, Oregon is the best documented example of that, where about 25 years ago, they had no more bikers than anybody else. And in the intervening decades, they spent a fair amount of money, I think about $30 million, which is half the price of a single highway clover leaf. But they spent, you know, $30 million on bike facilities. And now they bike 15 times as much as the rest of America. So it's a clear relationship between a limited investment and a significant outcome, which, of course, has a tremendous impact on the health of the citizens.
And picking up on this, I wanted to make another connection, which made me think regarding our economy and all this very intense talk of help to small businesses. I cannot imagine more powerful help, support, and suggestion for redevelopment of a small business is indeed walkability. I created a little expression here. Walkability is lifeability, because the idea of downtown has to provide whatever life essentials are needed. And we just cover this human interaction, transportation. And I'd like to see your points on revival, or if not revival, I'm going a little bit too far, but supporting and energizing small businesses, moms and pops, I think they call them.
Right.
I think that our feet and our eyes can be much happier in a small boutique. Maybe several of them will motivate us walking and learning about different things than being inside of the huge mall, which again...
Well, you know, this isn't... It's funny, this isn't in the book, but you're making me think that, the conventional suburban strip is far from the ideal circumstance for a smaller business because of the speed at which you're passing the different businesses. So as a driver on a suburban or ex-urban or just, you know, automotive-centric urban street, where you're going 20 or 30 or 40 miles an hour and you have occasional turnoffs into driveways to parking lots which hold small stores, and we all know what these places are like, these strip malls, there's this one sign, right, that stands up by the side of the road, and the one sign has about 10 or 12 different businesses on it, and there's no way you can read all the names of the businesses fast enough as you drive by, let alone, you know, investigate what kind of businesses these are. Whereas, of course, if you're walking down a street at 4 miles an hour, which is a typical, 3 or 4 miles an hour, which is a typical speed. Not only do you get to see the name of every store, but you get to look in the window, see what they're selling, and perhaps even bump into the proprietor and have a bit of a conversation. But there's a second issue, which is that if you go into a typical mall in America, shopping mall, you'll typically see almost nothing but chain stores. And the reason you'll see almost nothing but chain stores is that the mall developers need to get financing for their mall. And the more chains, particularly the anchors, but the more chains that they have signed up for that mall, the easier it is for them to get financing and the better financing they can get. And also they have much more confidence in the leases that they can sign. So whenever retail development, I should say whenever providing places to shop is done in conjunction with providing completely new real estate, for example, a giant mall, you have this mandate that pushes you away from mom and pops. Whereas, and Jane Jacobs talked about this in The Death and Life of Great American Cities, which is the best planning book ever written, in a street that has old buildings that haven't just been developed, and the rents, the mortgages are, the construction loan has been paid off, and the mortgage has been paid off, then there's the capacity among the building owner to welcome in either a shop or perhaps upstairs, some sort of small business tenant that doesn't pay the highest rent imaginable. One thing Jane Jacobs said was, new ideas need old buildings, because new ideas don't make money, at least not at first. And so, if you have some chain store or big corporation who's already figured out how to make it rich, they're welcome in a new building in which the lease, in which the mortgage has to be paid off. But if you're looking for a place to incubate new ideas where there's very little capacity to generate revenue early on, often cheap rents means older buildings.
And that, again, brings me to the thought, which I actually did not have as sharply as I have it now. You get, frankly, quite more educated, because the more variety you have, the more freedom merchants have and have this courage to expand and to risk in a positive way. The more feedback they can get from someone who is walking, not driving. So we really hit this curiosity, novelty, and certain things which are indeed only possible in a physical contact, which you just described. So I frankly feel that you should write another book as a continuation, because this is just a endless routes for us human who are really suffering from human communication. I like to bring another issue, which I was so clear while reading a chapter. It's called The Interesting Walk, because we're walking on the internet. We have another somewhat philosophical contradiction. We can take any walk we want, but we do not move. And again, we are with ourselves. And it is a fantastic tool. No one is going to argue with this. But if you not combine this with a do-it being in real life, then our young generation will be just frozen with the dozens of problems they have. So if you can tell us a little bit about this very wonderful chapter, the interesting walk in your book.
Well, I think, and I don't talk about it in the book, but I think the advent of the internet and the short attention spans that it generates only put greater pressure on us as designers to create environments that aren't boring. It's hard enough to get people to walk as it is, let alone imagining a society of grown children who are more used to and I mean grown children in every sense of the term, who are more used to instant gratification and a opportunity to you know, push a button and immediately change their environment. You know, I deal with it in a much more practical, less philosophical way. It's all part of, you know, it's all in the context of my discussion about how most American cities are trying to generate pedestrians by choice. And what I mean by that is that in most American cities, driving is still cheap enough and parking is still cheap enough. And car ownership is so ubiquitous that we're not so much trying to get people to get rid of their cars, at least not at first, as we're just trying to give them a alternative which is just as attractive. And, you know, for most American cities, which have reshaped themselves around the automobile, the idea of a large number of citizens actually choosing to not own a car and therefore to limit their access to huge swaths of their environment is not something that, you know, we could ask with probably great effectiveness. But in most cities in which I work, in most American cities, there are opportunities to create places either in the heart of the downtown or in smaller neighborhood centers that are already mixed use, interesting, have some historic fabric, and, you know, are the kind of places that would attract people who want that 24-hour live, work, play lifestyle, that it's at least there for them. And what we find in cities is that if you create a small kernel of that sort of walkability and livability, it can very quickly spread outward to infect, in a good way, the rest of the city. Not that the whole city will become walkable, but that we'll begin to create a network, perhaps of walkable places connected by transit, each one of which is delightful in its own way. But I talk about in the quest to achieve this pedestrian by choice in walkable city, I talk about how the walk, as you said, needs to be useful, which means the proper mix of uses. It needs to be safe, which we haven't talked about much at all, but that deals with whether the streets, sidewalks, and the whole streetscape are engineered in a way that gives cars the upper hand or gives pedestrians the upper hand, or at least gives them a fighting chance. The spaces need to be comfortable, as I discussed, with walls that properly shape the space. But they also need to be interesting. And in most American cities, making interesting spaces essentially means hiding parking. Because the great boredom of so many American cities, either at lower density with the surface parking lot or at higher density with the parking structure, is the absence of storefronts and other building faces, you know, friendly faces that you get instead of parking if you plan things properly. And what we've learned as designers, perhaps first demonstrated in Charleston, where Mayor Joe Riley has been pushing urbanism for 40 years, he's still mayor on his 10th term, is that it only takes about 25 feet of building to hide 250 feet of garage. And he's got a number of garages in Charleston that either place shops on the front on the first floor and parking above, or sit back 25 feet from the street edge, and there's a thin, nice-looking building hiding it from the street. About half the larger cities in America today, and very few of the smaller ones, have rules on the book that say you can't build a parking structure downtown unless you activate the first floor with retail or create some what we call a liner building, a thin edge that places a human face on the street. Most smaller cities don't have rules like this. And then there's the requirement that new places, when they're created, also hide the parking. And it's easier when you're making a new town. So, for example, Celebration, the new town that Disney built in Orlando, which has its problems but is generally speaking an intelligently planned community, you know, the downtown blocks where the shopping is are actually big blocks with donut holes in the middle where there are surface parking lots that are just completely hidden from view. So there's wayfinding that directs you to this parking. But when you're walking down or driving down any of the streets, you don't have to look at it. And that's the easiest thing in the world to do if you know to do it. But so many places in America, and so many American designers, frankly, don't understand the phenomenon that happens when your typical pedestrian comes up to a parking lot. And I could name a dozen lovely historic main streets in the U.S. that I and thousands of other people have walked down and turned around and doubled back the minute that that first building, that first Dunkin' Donuts or Safeway or, Jiffy Lube was allowed to sit back behind its parking lot. And this fundamental decision, does the building meet the sidewalk edge with its front door or does it sit behind parking, is the decision that tells pedestrians whether they're in a place that's for them or that puts the car before them. And many cities still, as a matter of fact, are building, are allowing the construction in their theoretical or once walkable downtowns of buildings set back behind parking lots. And most urban design codes and, you know, construction codes and zoning codes in America, which control how our communities are built, have thousands of pages talking about parking ratios and lighting ratios and all this technical stuff that has no relationship to whether places are comfortable or not, but yet doesn't exert any mandate about placing parking behind buildings instead of in front of buildings. So even our codes are, you know, our codes aren't helping us at all.
And probably, I don't know if you, at what degree you agree with me, that sometimes seemingly logical planning and thinking inside of the office will be in a contrast or maybe even a conflict to the real world, to the real life. And I'm sure that you've been witnessing a number of those discussions just because of the nature of your profession. Can you take us inside of one of those meetings and how can you see them to be more progressive and more multi-planning thinkers?
Do you mean a meeting within
inside
a city planning?
Hall. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, the good news is that everyone gets this. The challenge is that the existing, to get technical for a minute, the existing codes need to either be overruled or replaced. And we've been seeing a good three decades now of quote-unquote new urban work. At first it was called neo-traditional work, then it was new urban, now we're calling it walkable. We can call it lots of different things. But we've seen a good two or three decades in which most projects that succeeded by exception. And succeeded by people like, you know, Andre Stuani and Elizabeth Plater-Zyberg and myself going before the city council of a beautiful town like, for example, Mount Pleasant, South Carolina, which is right next to Charleston, and say, asking them, you know, what is your favorite part of Mount Pleasant? And they say, well, we love our old little Main Street right here. Well, did you know that you couldn't build that today? Did you know that if you wanted to have any more of that, you couldn't? Did you know that it's illegal? And what's your favorite neighborhood, a residential neighborhood? And they would point to some great, you know, beautiful tree-lined street from the 1920s. Say, well, did you know that this neighborhood is not only illegal today because of lot coverage requirements and floor area ratio requirements and setback requirements, but that if someone's house in one of these historic neighborhoods burns down, you have to replace it with a house that doesn't line up with any of the other houses on the street because the setback requirement is 30 feet deeper, for example. When I wanted to build my house in Washington, D.C., which I ultimately did, I didn't own a car. My family didn't own a car. We're three blocks from a stop of the Green Line on the famous Metro rail system here in D.C. I belonged to Zipcar, so I had urban car share available in my neighborhood. there are like four bus routes that run within a block of my house. And yet I was required to have an on-site parking space. None of my neighbors in this historic neighborhood had an on-site parking space. None of them had garages. None of them had driveways. There was a rear alley, but no one had any sort of, garage or parking place off of it. And yet, with all this example of historic fabric, and the fact that for me to create my own on-site parking space, I would have had to rip out a historic granite curb, remove an on-street parking space to access a driveway, and build a driveway onto my site, effectively exchanging a public good for a private good. Even though all of those circumstances existed, I was required to, and I had no car, I was required to provide myself with a parking space. I got around it. It took 9 months and ended up being a public battle that was written up in USA Today. But the point is that we have a set of rules on the books that make it impossible for us to either create new neighborhoods of the quality that we used to make, or even to place new buildings in our historic neighborhoods that are anything like the wonderful historic fabric that makes those neighborhoods so special. So for many years, we made better places, either at the scale of the house or the scale of the community, by exception, by getting a planned unit development permission, by getting some sort of special, most zoning codes, thankfully, when it comes to large developments like, new villages, of which we've built, many in America, have a special clause where you're allowed to experiment. But if you do so, you open the whole thing up to a huge array of public hearings and public interventions, and God knows what citizen is going to decide they don't like what you're doing and delay you for 5 years, as has happened to many of the projects I've worked on. But that was the first half of this effort. The second half, which began very early but has only become common more recently, is this understanding now that we have to throw out these suburban codes that we've imported into our cities and replace them with codes that reflect what our cities are really like, and more to the point, reflect those things that matter to the quality of the urban realm. So rather than focusing so much on parking minimums and, floor area ratios, which is the ratio of the square footage that you contain in your building to the size of your lot, it's like a technical statistic that only a lawyer could love. Instead of focusing on these things, we focus on where the building sits, where the parking goes, how the building meets the sidewalk, whether there are balconies and awnings and porches, how tall the building is, and the things that matter in terms of what makes it friendly to its surrounding environment, which is the exact opposite of how the codes have been for so long. So there's a whole new family of ordinances. They're called form-based codes, to contrast them from what we've been doing for many years, which is use-based codes, and the fact that most American cities are segregated not by building type, but by nowadays. Buildings used to be segregated by building type. Skyscrapers were near skyscrapers, row houses near row houses, lofts near lofts, apartment villas near apartment villas. But starting around the 50s, we began segregating by use. So you could only have housing near housing. You could only have offices near offices. That had to be separate from where the medical offices were. That had to be separate from where the light industrial was, even though the light industrial wasn't polluting, et cetera. So we used to have use-based zoning codes, and we're slowly replacing those with form-based zoning codes, the most famous of which is called the SMART code. And if you go online, you can find it. If you Google the word SMART code, one word, S-M-A-R-T-C-O-D-E, you'll find your way to this new collection of ordinances that are free. You can basically download it off the web and look at how it might fit into your community. The problem, of course, is that the expense of taking this generic code off of the page and making it law, and the public process that you need to go through to accomplish that is necessarily quite labor-intensive and therefore expensive. A number of larger cities now have replaced their entire zoning ordinances. Many smaller cities, but a few larger cities like Miami, at a cost of many million dollars, threw out their old code and replaced it with a smart code. So this trend is ongoing and powerful. It's unfortunate that it's necessary, but it's certainly, you know, these hidden subdivision codes and zoning ordinances are the software that determines how our cities are made. And so it's only by changing their coding that we can change our cities back to the way they used to be.
Jeff, I just wanted to make a few shorter comments because regrettably we're coming towards the end of our program, but I wanted to make sure that you are friends at least with one of the major politicians who will help to adopt this new sets of codes and will make life so much more simple, cheaper, and less bureaucratic, because unfortunately I only know too well what does it mean to get permission to do something. And also a historic district, even though has its own fantastic roots of history, needs to be respected and treasured. But again, often it is not treated as a historic area with the proper preservation or thoughtful addition, but just as a cold sets of rules and regulations. So I would say that what you just described is so, so relevant. I'm glad to hear that there is a movement and gradually there is a replacement of those old-fashioned codes will be with much more modern, much more adaptable to everyday life. And I wanted to ask you, even though I cannot imagine a single person who did not hear about you, your book, and this just tremendously relevant concept with a promising practical thing, where one would be able to find and to buy your book, and how they can find you on your website?
Well, I love that question.
so
the book is in just about every bookstore right now. Some sold out over Christmas, but supposedly you're restocking because it only came out in November. So it should be in most bookstores. Again, it's called Walkable City. My name is Jeff Speck, S-P-E-C-K. I have a website called jeffspeck.com, J-E-F-F-S-P-E-C-K.com. I'm also on Twitter with the handle JeffSpeckAICP, AICP as in Albert, Indigo, Clarence, Possibility, AICP, is my planning license, what my planning license is called. So JeffSpeckAICP is my Twitter handle, and I do a lot of tweeting from the book. The book is, of course, available through all electronic booksellers and sold mostly on Amazon, and also an audio version. So it's available digitally as well as in print, but an audio version is coming out from Audible any day now. So if you want to wait for that, that might also be something to look into.
Wonderful. Cannot thank you enough. This is hopefully a wonderful panoramic view of our immediate future. We covered so many aspects already, but there are so many to be discovered, enjoyed, if one will read your book, if didn't read already. And I wanted to wish you an inspiration, patience, and again, thank you for sharing your fantastic promise for us to become again alive and well.
Thank you. I'm delighted that you find it worthy of talking about. It's clear to me from the conversation that you're thinking about some of the social aspects of what I'm interested in a more philosophical and even deeper level than I am. So I particularly appreciate that, and I'm glad that someone who thinks as deeply about these social issues as you do find the discussion in the book to be so relevant.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I did enjoy our mutuality, and I will again say that people like yourself have this multi-vision, multi-energy. We wish you to thrive, and maybe we will have you back again if you will have another chapter in our revision of America.
Thanks again for the conversation.
It was my absolute pleasure. That was my another program with Jeff Speck, who truly visionary of this country, and who took on the surface a simple idea as returning to walking and stretched it to most incredibly powerful message. Once we start to walk, we will see the world in a deeper and wider way. That was Lead a Life with my program, which I will continue in a couple of weeks. And I'm Lina Mirmond. Thank you for listening. Wish you well. And hopefully you start new year with new thoughts, already some accomplishments, and good health. Thank you.